Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Ana Hernandez, a member of the Club International Relations Forum and your chair for tonight's program. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, author Mavish Khan, who will speak to us about My Guantanamo Diary. She is an American lawyer and journalist, born in Michigan to immigrant Afghan parents, who has written about her experiences as a translator for Guantanamo prisoners. It should be a fascinating discussion from someone who's seen it up close. Please let us welcome Ms. Khan.
Hello. Thank you all for coming. I know there's many other things you could be doing on this beautiful summer night. And thanks also to the Commonwealth Club for having me. Can you guys all hear me? Okay, cool. So basically what I want to do tonight is tell you a little bit about my experiences at Guantanamo and about some of the detainees that I met and just what it's like on the base, and then I want to turn it over to you guys because I'm sure you have questions and are wondering what it's like over there. But essentially, I got involved while I was a law student, and I was taking an international law class, and I was studying the federal torture statutes and just remember being baffled at how Washington policymakers were debating the legality of these medieval torture techniques because, you know, once upon a time they were called Chinese water torture, and today in America it's called waterboarding. But other than that, I was also just outraged that our administration had been creating these legal loopholes and had created this lawless state where men were being hidden from the world and never charged. And so the reason that I initially wanted to get involved at Guantanamo was for these legal principles that America was founded upon, the conviction that every man should be charged before he's imprisoned and that everybody has a right to have a fair shot at proving their innocence, just like any alleged rapist or murderer in America. But once I got to the base, the purpose of why I continued to stay involved shifted for me. And just to give a brief background, when I was a law student, I Googled the cases that I was studying, and I found out who the attorneys were, and I got in touch that had taken the cases up to the Supreme Court and got in touch with the Center for Constitutional Rights. And I got my foot in the door as an interpreter because my parents are of Pashtun descent, and we spoke Pashto at home. So that's how I got my foot in the door. And then eventually, once I got to know the attorneys that I was working with, I asked for a case of my own after I graduated, and I represent one Afghan detainee now. But I remember my first trip to the base very clearly. I remember being nervous and scared that I was going to meet somebody who was Al-Qaeda or Taliban, and being scared that they wouldn't want to speak to me because I was a woman or to sit down with me or, you know, look at me. And I remember walking into that meeting room and opening the door, and there was this man standing in the corner of the room, and he had his legs shackled to the floor, and he was called 1154. That's what the military knew him as, and he looked just as frightened as I did. And When I walked in, I'd covered my hair because I didn't know how conservative he would be and whether he'd be offended if I hadn't. And so he smiled when he saw me because I was wearing this embroidered shawl from Afghanistan. And I smiled back at him and gave him the universal Islamic greeting, which translates to may peace be upon you. And he smiled back and gave me, he responded, and I went over and shook hands with my first terrorist. And I sat down, and the more I learned about 1154, as the guards called him, because none of the guards at Guantanamo know what the detainees' names are. They're all serial numbered. And the more I learned about him and his story, the less sense it made to me why he was there. I mean, I went in there with no opinion about who the detainees were and, you know, whether they were good or bad, just that they deserved a fair trial, just like, you know, any other person in prison. But 1154's real name was Dr. Ali Shah Mousavi. He was a pediatrician, and he worked for the United Nations to help increase Afghan electoral support for the new democracy. He had a wife who was an economist, and they fled Afghanistan to Iran during the era of the Taliban. And he only returned after the Taliban were toppled to work for the UN. He wanted to run for parliament in the new democracy. And he was also a Shiite Muslim, and Shiites were a persecuted minority by the Taliban. And so here was this guy, and he was being accused of being Taliban, and it just didn't make any sense. Another allegation against him was that when he was younger, he fought against communism, that he opposed the Soviets invading Afghanistan. And that was an American-backed operation. And so it just made absolutely no sense why this guy was there. And the second detainee that I met the following day was prisoner number 1009. And his real name is Haji Nusrath, and he's an 80-year-old paraplegic. He couldn't walk. He was brought to Guantanamo on a stretcher, and it was alleged that he was an enemy combatant fighting on the battlefield, yet he'd suffered two strokes 15 years before, which left him paralyzed and bedridden. And despite his health, the military made no concessions for his situation and for his old age, and his immobile, swollen legs were also shackled to the floor. And it was then, this was my first base trip, and these were the first two guys that I met. I went in there expecting to meet Al-Qaeda, and I meet a pediatrician and this 80-year-old. And at that point, I just felt totally duped and deceived. And I realized that at the heart of this big Gitmo debate lies something much more fundamental than habeas corpus and due process, because this is about people's lives. And we often don't hear about the Guantanamo detainees as individuals because, I mean, to all of you collectively, you probably know them as, you know, the Guantanamo detainees. It's one nameless, faceless entity of foreigners who we're told are the worst of the worst. And they've been stripped of their names and hidden because not knowing who they are as individuals makes their abuse much more palatable. And I believe that if Americans knew who was really at Guantanamo, and if this wasn't, you know, shrouded in mystery off in Cuba, this base wouldn't be open as long as it would. And, you know, if Haji Nusrath and Dr. Ali Shah were to show up in U.S. courts or in America, they would be on Good Morning America tomorrow and CNN the next day, and Americans would just be like, this is the war on terror. And that's not to say that I believe all Guantanamo detainees are innocent and good, because I don't. There are bad people at Guantanamo. For example, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, alleged 9/11 mastermind. But when you don't have a process and a trial, it's hard to separate the good from the bad, and you have good people swept up with the bad ones, and it creates these situations. And I also don't want all of you to get the wrong idea about my book, because it's not just about torture and these poor people who were, you know, wronged, and because that's all depressing. But the book is also, you know, it's a behind-the-scenes look at Guantanamo. It's about who the guards were, who the detainees were as individuals, and it's about interfaith dialogue between attorneys and their clients, and it's about friendship that was formed between lawyers and interpreters with their clients, and it's also a journey of heritage, because when I went to Guantanamo initially, I'd always sort of been debating this East and West balancing thing. My parents are ethnically Pashtun, which the Pashtun are from Afghanistan and northern Pakistan, and with the detainees, I was constantly, I mean, they would quiz me about everything from, like, you know, they all wanted to know whether I was married, and they gave me career advice, and we formed these just... Guantanamo is such an intense environment, that relationships and friendships and, you know, your character, everything comes out very intensely. And through these meetings with the Guantanamo detainees and our back and forth banter about East and West, and, you know, some of the lawyers were curious about how some of the detainees had two wives and how they juggled two wives and what the sleeping arrangements were. And the detainees wanted to know why Americans drank to the point of impaired intoxication or, you know, dated on the internet. And things like that we don't hear about on the news, but there was a lot of dialogue that went on, and friendships that were formed. And I learned a lot about where I came from through these men. And it strengthened my desire to go to Afghanistan. And I eventually went twice to gather exonerating evidence for clients. My own client is a real estate developer and a car salesman. And I went to Kabul and found land title deeds and things to, you know, support what his story. And I found all of that and brought it back. But I've also found that Afghanistan is this beautiful country that is just perpetually devastated by tragedy. The Afghans are extremely hospitable and charming people who are just, you know, constantly torn apart by war. And I learned a lot about all of that from these men. And I tried over the last 2 years to bring them a semblance of their culture, because that's what they had been stripped of. And it was often small things, like I would bring them Starbucks chai because it was the closest thing to the kind of tea they drank in Afghanistan, or learn their favorite foods and tried to cook those for them. And just anything to break up the monotony of their detention, because they had been stripped of their individualism. And I think when I went to Guantanamo, I assumed that everybody who was there must have done something to have been brought there. I mean, that's the natural assumption. You must have done something to get there. But what most Americans don't know, and what I didn't know at the time, is about the U.S. military's bounty program, which has largely been unreported in the U.S. media. And what happened was the U.S. airdropped thousands of bounty leaflets all across Afghanistan, offering up to $25,000 per Taliban and al-Qaeda. And when you offer that kind of money to an Afghan, I mean, in Afghanistan, the average Afghan makes about 80 cents a day. and that's about $300 a year. And when you offer $25,000, and the pictures of those bounty leaflets are in my book, although, you know, the Department of Defense denies that they ever did this, they, you know, it's like winning the Super Lotto jackpot because, and beyond that, Afghanistan is a lawless country, and there's tribal and ethnic feuds that go back generations and political feuds, and it created this financial incentive for people to turn their enemies in and people that they've had issues with over years. And that's not to say that having a bounty program is like wrong or against any sort of international standards, because it's not, but when there's no investigative process that follows offering, you know, these large amounts of cash bounties, it is at least a cause for a second look. And to me, and also the other thing was the Associated Press, when they sued the Department of Defense for information under the Freedom of Information Act on who the Guantanamo detainees were, because initially we didn't even know their names, we didn't know what country they were from. And under that lawsuit came all sorts of data, which was analyzed by Seton Hall Law University. And from that, they concluded that 86% of the detainees at Guantanamo are there as a result of being turned in by locals who were benefiting at a time financially from these bounty leaflets. But beyond all of this is that this is about, you know, human beings' lives, and it's hard to picture this because we don't know the Guantanamo detainees as individuals. We just know them collectively. But I remember Haji Nasrat, the 80-year-old paraplegic, and he, in that first meeting, would just ask me why journalists weren't allowed at Guantanamo, why his story wasn't being told, and why he was being hidden from the world, because he kept saying, you know, if I've done something wrong, why not put me on a public trial and prove that I've done something wrong and then lock me up? And what really touched me was when we left, because Haji did something that I think about often, and I'm going to read you this passage from the end of our meeting. As the meeting ended, it was obvious that the old man was in pain. His legs hurt, and he tried to stand and stretch them. He pushed hard against the tabletop with his palms, trying to lift his weight. I leapt to his side and helped him stand. He gripped the edge of the table for balance and exhaled deeply. A few moments later, I helped him sit back down. As we started collecting our things to go, I turned back to Haji, who was watching us gather up pizza boxes and pistachio shells and unfinished baklava. The military didn't allow any food to be left with the detainees, so we had to take any leftovers with us. Bache, my child, tell your mother and your father that an old man with a white beard sends his salams, he said. I responded with the customary reply, Wa alaikum assalam, and may peace also be upon you. I adjusted my shawl one last time and glanced at him. He was quiet for a moment, then he opened his heavy arms to me and I embraced him. He pushed my head into his white prison uniform and for several moments prayed for me as Peter washed. Insha'Allah, God willing, you will find a home that makes you happy. Insha'Allah, you will be a mother one day. Insha'Allah, you will always have a family that will protect you. Insha'Allah, you will finish law school and continue to help us. I'm going to let you guys finish the prayer. But the reason why it really touched me was because Haji Nasrat was somebody who didn't have anything. Like, he didn't have his health. He didn't have his freedom. He was kept in a cage that I wouldn't put my dog in. And here he was praying for me when we were leaving. And I just thought that spoke volumes about his goodness of spirit because, you know, Haji Nasrat is somebody's grandfather, and a lot of the Guantanamo detainees are kept in these solitary concrete boxes, which are about 7 by 8 feet square, which is 56 square feet, It's a little bit bigger than a king-size mattress. And in that space, is there bed? Is there a toilet? They eat every meal alone. They spend 23 hours a day there. And they are, often never see sunlight for months on end because their recreation time will come when they are sleeping in the middle of the night, and they'll be told, it's rec time, let's go. And oftentimes they don't even get that 1 hour. But, not all of the detainees were as polite and, you'd feel sorry for as Haji Nusrat and Dr. Alisha. There was one guy who was a goat herder, and he was trying to learn English. He spoke pretty good English that he'd learned over the course of 4 years, and he was my favorite because it was easy to meet him. He made me laugh, and he was my age, and he was kind of a misogynist, and I probably wouldn't have liked him if I met him outside of Guantanamo, but within the confines of Guantanamo, it was entertaining, and I remember in our second or third meeting, he handed me this piece of paper, and he wanted me to help him translate his new vocabulary plan, and it was just this huge list of cuss words. And so I was like, his name was Taj Muhammad. I'm like, I don't know how to say bestiality in Pashto, I'm sorry, or intercourse or horny, because those were the words on the list. And he was like, no, you have to. I'm like, I learned Pashto from my parents. And so, eventually I was like, all right, I'll teach you what bestiality means. And I went, I explained the goats that he tends to, and he got the picture and he jotted it down in Pashto. And at that point I got the feeling that he knew, he told me the guards had made out this list for him and that he had no idea what they meant, but I have a feeling that he did. But the main takeaway from this book isn't about torture and, hardship. You will laugh a lot, and you'll get to know another culture, another part of the world, and you'll understand where these people come from. And whether or not you believe their stories and their perspectives is up to you. I've never said that I believe that all of the detainees were, innocent or even entirely truthful, but I believe that their perspectives must be aired because they've never had a voice as, as I said before, any alleged rapist and murderer in America has had an open court, and we don't know anything about them. And so this book is their voice, and it's also, it's a story that transcends Guantanamo. It's about, friendship and betrayal and forgiveness, because I visited a lot of the detainees after they were released from Guantanamo in Afghanistan, and their stories panned out. They were who they said they were, and some of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, sleep in fetal positions, and others seemingly seem to be adjusting back into society, and I don't know how angry some might be versus others, but and still others continue to suffer and are damaged from what they have experienced. And I want to leave you with a sort of grim suicide note that Jemma al-Dosri, who was a detainee for several years at Guantanamo, wrote to his attorney. And he had attempted suicide many times. I think it was about a dozen. And this particular incident, he asked his attorney for a bathroom break, and he handed him a letter. And when his attorney called the guards and told him he wanted to take this bathroom break, the detainee Jemma was taking a long time, and so he stuck his head into the cell, and before he could call out his name to see what was taking so long, he saw this huge pool of blood and called out and just yanked the door open and saw his client hang. He had hung himself and slashed his arms, and And he, you know, raced up to the cage because they're put in cages when the lawyers, you know, leave for whether it's to go to the bathroom or for lunch. They're put in this 7 by 8 foot cage. And so he was hanging there and he couldn't reach him. And so he started screaming and the guards came and he was ushered out. And Jimma survived that and he went on to try to commit suicide other times. But this is the letter that the attorney later read. October 2005. And these are the words of Jamal Dosre. In fact, I don't know how to begin or where to begin. I feel very sorry for forcing you to see a human being who suffered too much dying before your eyes. There was no alternative to make our voice heard by the world from the depths of the detention centers. I hope you will always remember that you met and sat with a human being called Jumma, who suffered too much and was abused in his belief, his self, in his dignity, and also in his humanity. He was imprisoned, tortured, and deprived of his homeland, his family, and his young daughter. Remember that there are hundreds of detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. They are in the same situation of suffering and misfortune. They were captured, tortured, detained with no offense or reason. Their lives might end like mine. When you remember me in my last gasps of life before dying, while my soul is leaving my body to rise to its creator, remember that the world let us down and let our case down. Remember that our government let us down. Remember the unreasonable delay of the courts in looking into our case to side with the victims of injustice. If there were judges that had been fair, I wouldn't have been wrapped in death shrouds now, and my family, my father, my mother, my brothers, sisters, and my little daughter would not have to lose me, but what else can I do? Take some of my blood, take pieces of my death shrouds, take some of my remains, take pictures of my dead body when I am placed in my grave. Send it to the world, to the judges, the people with live conscience, to the people whose principle, to the people with principles and values. At this moment, I see death looming in front of me while I write this letter. Death has a bad odor that cannot be smelled except by those who are going through its agony. Farewell. I thank you for everything you have done for me, but I have a final request. Show the world the letters I gave you. Let the world read them. Let the world know the agonies of the detainees in Cuba. Prisoner of deprivation, Jumma Abdel Latif al-Dosri.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Khan. Now we would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to My Guantanamo Diary with Mavish Khan, who will now take your questions, questions from the audience, and there is a microphone over there. So,
thank you so much. I really learned a lot from your speech. My question is regarding other attorneys. Have you talked with them? And since you have the language and connection with Afghanistan that they don't have, how are they relating to the prisoners?
The relationships between attorneys and detainees vary a lot. I mean, some detainees never form trust with their attorneys, and they often ask their attorneys not to come back because they feel that they're interrogators and they can't distinguish between the two. And others are fortunate enough to form long-lasting friendships and bonds with their attorneys. Some detainees feel that having attorneys makes no difference in the legal process because they don't, I mean, it's not determinative why they're released. Initially, there were about almost 800 detainees. Today, there's almost 300, and it's not known why they're released. We would like to think that we're doing something to help out the process, but it's largely undeterminative.
You know, there's no excuse for inhumane treatment, but what model would you suggest as to how you deal with these prisoners of war, because that's really what these folks are? What is the crime? Because they were belonging to a group, or because they shot at the United States, or they just don't like the United States? For what's a crime? And secondly, how do you ever put on a trial? Do you bring their enemies from Afghanistan to testify under oath that they really are a Taliban or a Al-Qaeda or something like that? And do they get to bring from Afghanistan supporting witnesses to show that they're a car salesman and they're just an honest citizen and this other person is lying? How do you handle this stuff? And then what kind of sentence do they get? Do they get 100 years until the war on terror is finally ended? How do you deal with this kind of prisoner of war situation, which is not a normal state versus state?
Well, the problem is in Vietnam, in Gulf War I and II, we had these Geneva Convention Article 5 hearings where when prisoners were arrested on the ground, they were given these hearings, and it was determined, you know, whether they had in fact committed anything or not, and there was an investigative process. And that simply did not happen in Afghanistan. And furthermore, it's hard to know what somebody is guilty of when they're never charged of anything. And so the question is, you know, what are they innocent of or guilty of when there was never a crime that they had been charged of? When, I mean, I visited Haji Nusrath when he was released, the 80-year-old, and he was never charged with a crime. And I visited Dr. Ali Shah, who was also released. And they were never told why they were picked up. It's speculated that, you know, Dr. Ali Shah came from a prominent family. He wanted to run for parliament. He could have had political opponents. And it's possible that somebody benefited financially from the bounties. It's really unknown. As far as trials in the United States, we've had trials for terrorism suspects before. I mean, the World Trade Center bombing the first time, we tried those individuals on U.S. soil, and we were able to deal with classified information, and we have ways of doing that. And in terms of witnesses, absolutely. It involves going to those countries. The individuals often made lists of witnesses that they would have liked to call for the military to, you know, hear their statements. And the military has never made any effort to locate those witnesses when they were often very easy to take statements and affidavits from. I did it. I went to Afghanistan solo and collected affidavits and met with witnesses. And that's what a trial is designed for. As in terms of sentences, it would also depend on what the crime was, but out of almost 800 detainees, less than 20 today have ever been accused of anything. So it's, again, a question of why are they there? And 86% of the detainees at Guantanamo were brought there, not as a result of U.S. intelligence, but turned in by locals who were benefiting financially at a time when the bounty program was in state.
Thank you for your talk. I'm a current law student and a human rights revolutionary activist, and I just wanted to hear more about how we can combat the prison industrial complex and how that's playing out in terms of how international laws are being violated and what can be done to bring people who are responsible for crafting the legal justifications to trial for war crimes. I'm really concerned about, as you pointed out, a humanistic approach and paradigm and framework that is oftentimes not taught within the legal environment, particularly people not charged with crimes being held there for 5 years that we know is completely unconstitutional according to the Hamden case. And why does that continue to perpetuate what can be done from a grassroots approach to bring people who are constructing these laws and violating these laws to justice and to make sure that people's human rights are fought for and to stop this politics of cruelty?
And that's the essence of what habeas corpus is all about. And habeas corpus comes from the Latin, which means you have the body. And it basically is enshrined in our U.S. Constitution. And it's there to prevent imprisonment without charge and to protect individuals from these human rights abuses. And when you strip somebody of that right, this is what happens. And we've seen this in U.S. history before. It happened in World War II with Japanese Americans being imprisoned on the West Coast. And there were about 100,000 Japanese who were never charged of any crime and never convicted of espionage. And yet this continues to happen at a time when we fear and when It seems that the U.S. Constitution and the principles go out the window at a time when national security is at stake, but those are the times when the Constitution are supposed to step in and protect individuals' rights. As far as what to do, it's often a difficult question to answer. Make a lot of noise. Most Americans don't know who these people are as individuals, and I feel that the Guantanamo detainees are more fortunate than the detainees in a much larger organ that is the CIA detention system, which includes black sites all over the world that we don't hear about. I mean, there are countless innumerable prisoners who we perhaps will never hear about, who are suffering far more egregious abuses. And I think that the media is a powerful tool to help raise awareness, which was part of the reason I wrote the book.
Hi. Fantastic speech, by the way.
Thank you.
I just have two questions. One to start is the soldiers themselves that you obviously had a lot of encounter with going through. What were their feelings? I mean, they obviously even had more in-depth contact with prisoners, maybe not beneficial contact in any regard, but a lot of connection. So yeah, there are any feelings and thoughts that they had?
When I went to Guantanamo, I came in with two biases, that all of the detainees would be, you know, maybe Taliban or Al-Qaeda and must have done something, and the other was that all of the soldiers would be hostile and aloof and, you know, these robotic jerk type people. But in fact, I found I was wrong about both. A lot of the guards and military escorts were very decent human beings. I keep in touch with some of them who I've formed friendships with, and some of them did believe that what was going on at Guantanamo was wrong. Others had no idea. They were simply guards and military escorts, and most guards don't even know the names of the detainees they're guarding. They are serial numbered, and I don't know if I said this before, but serial numbers are for things that are inanimate. They're made in a series, and when you give something a name, whether it's an animal or a person, it makes it individual and unique. But what happened with the Guantanamo detainees in Bagram before they were brought to Gitmo was, Bagram is an air base in northern Afghanistan, just north of Kabul, is these men's beards, eyebrows, hair, facial body hair was shaved. They all looked the same at that point. They were all dressed the same in similar prison uniforms, and they were all serial numbered. And we didn't go as far as tattooing them, which has happened in other parts of the world in different wars. But when these soldiers are told that this man is a terrorist and this guy's only known as 1154, it's easier to abuse and kick it and make it cry and, you know, than it is when you know that 1154 is a pediatrician who has a wife who's an economist and is a lot more like you than different. But unfortunately, yeah.
I'm just going to, another person, but do you know the names or contact info of any major players in the legal movement or laws in Congress at the moment whose intent is geared towards providing rights and allowances and an actual introduction of habeas corpus, to some extent at least, to these people?
The Center for Constitutional Rights is pretty active on that front, and they give regular talks in front of Congress. So that's a good place to start, and it's based in New York.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
I have to comment that the practice of assigning people numbers and not using names and of shaving their heads and things is routine in every prison facility in the U.S. I've been a prison chaplain in San Francisco and Alameda County. I also was in the Marine Corps and did the same thing to us when we joined up. Absolutely, and you don't get called by your name, not for a long time. When I joined the Marine Corps in 1966, they, at least in boot camp, they did talk to us a little bit about not following illegal orders. I was curious because if I was running a small company and violated rules of NAFTA, I could stand to do jail time for it. The Nuremberg Charter and the UN Charter and the Geneva Conventions are duly ratified treaties, so their violation constitutes a federal felony. So crimes against peace, like conspiring to start an aggressive war or transferring prisoners illegally, which is a violation under Geneva Convention and UN Charter rules, all those are felonies, and a bunch of them are capital felonies. And we hung a bunch of Germans and Japanese for these at the end of World War II. My question is this. Would it not be possible and quite proper for any federal prosecutor in the U.S. to file charges as federal capital felonies on these crimes against George Bush, Dick Cheney, and the whole cabinet, and a whole long list, if you want the list? Why can't that be done by any federal prosecutor? That's the question. Not politically, but legally. Why can it not be done?
I think legally the problem might be because the Department of Defense has responded to any attempts to file complaints, even to collect compensation, with the answer that, you know, this was classified information and we can't disclose this, so we can't go to trial over this because it's an issue of national security. And they simply hide behind secret evidence about, you know, why they've done what they've done. But I completely am on your page.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm Dr. Reuven Jaffe. Can you differentiate or clarify the discussion now about the last 100 prisoners who will be remaining in Guantanamo as compared to these next 200 and the process of their release? Are you aware of that, and can you clarify that at all?
The last 100?
Once these next 200 are theoretically supposed to be released through whatever process.
Right.
There's supposed to be 100 left. They're supposed to be the hardcore. Who knows? Are you able to talk about that? I mean,
sure.
You've already talked about the first 300 that have been released. Are you able to talk about these last two?
Well,
groups?
The Supreme Court has ruled that they do have a right to habeas corpus, and theoretically, they should be given trials. My personal belief is that the vast majority of them will never see a day in U.S. civilian court because it would bring a great shame upon this country if we saw individuals like Dr. Ali Shah and Haji Nusrat and Taj Muhammad and on come into court with no evidence that they had seemingly done anything against the United States. As far as the high-value detainees, it is possible that they will get trials. Most Americans are also not aware that the 15 high-value detainees, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the others, were brought to Guantanamo on Guantanamo's fifth anniversary and sort of paraded before the press as if to say, hey, we do have bad guys here. But in terms of the remaining 277 or so prisoners that are left, there are also issues of finding places for them because some of their home countries do not accept them. And as was the case with the Chinese Uyghur detainees, who some of whom have been granted political asylum in Albania, but it's a complicated process, to say the least. The president has conceded that the Supreme Court, you know, has made their decision. He has also stated that he disagrees with it and is aligned more with the dissenting opinion. I don't believe that the vast majority of Guantanamo detainees will ever see an impartial trial. I strongly believe that they will be transferred home before that, as has been the case a little bit before and recently after the Supreme Court decision. the transfers to their home countries have increased, and I think it would be, it would just cause so much shame to our country to see who we've actually been holding there. You're welcome.
We have about 10 more minutes, and thank you, Ms. Kan. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to My Guantanamo Diary with Mavish Kan, who will, okay, so we'll take more questions.
How many people have died in Guantanamo Bay? Just a shot in the dark.
Four people the U.S. military have committed suicide. There was one individual who was suffering from colon cancer for a long time, and he has died recently also at Guantanamo. Of the three out of the four who have allegedly committed suicide, I've written a chapter in the book about that, and one profiles Salah al-Aslami. He's a 23-year-old Yemeni detainee, and his family rejected the notion that that it was suicide, and they wanted a second autopsy done. And when his body was returned to Yemen, they hired independent Swiss pathologists. And this was reported in the European press, but it never made it to the American press. But what the Swiss pathologists from Geneva concluded was that the U.S. military said that they'd committed suicide by hanging the three of them in a joint asymmetric warfare pact against the United States. And the pathologists concluded that it was inconclusive from their autopsy because the military had removed all of the organs in their throat, their larynx, pharynx, anything that would allow them to assess how they committed suicide. And they requested anatomical samples of the missing organs, and the military has never complied. That was with the Yemeni detainee. As far as the two Saudis who the U.S. alleges committed suicide in this joint pact, and I don't know what happened on that night because there was never an investigative process. They supposedly wrote suicide letters that the public has never seen and committed suicide in this joint pact. And I don't know what happened. It is possible that they committed suicide. I think killing detainees makes really bad press, but it's also, you know, questionable. Like, why were their organs removed? And the other detainees had their liver removed and other major organs. And it at least, you know, the families would like a further investigation, and it's something that's been unanswered and unaddressed.
Thank you for your presentation. What about reparations to the individuals and their families who have suffered?
A lot of the individuals who have been released have requested compensation for lost wages, and I don't know exactly what the state is in terms of those complaints filed. I do know that the general position that the Department of Defense takes is that to engage in such lawsuits would be, they wouldn't be able to go forward with it because it would involve having to disclose classified information. So again, they say, you know, this information is classified about why they were there, and this is an issue of national security, and so it's hard to get into a compensatory damages suit when there is no, when they're hiding behind secret evidence.
I would like to inquire further about what can be done from a public policy perspective. We know that there are international laws against torture. Less than 2 weeks ago, Stephen Rohde spoke at a town hall in Berkeley, put on by No to Torture, John, You Must Go. And at that town hall, Stephen Rohde looked at how torture attaches universal jurisdiction, and how there's been a recent book put out titled The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, and that book puts forth a lot of the legal arguments for how we can go about holding these people accountable under international law. This is also particularly pressing from a human rights perspective because there was a congressional hearing that in which John Yoo and Addington testified that certain war crimes weren't necessarily war crimes, and they weren't using international law, and they took the definition of torture from a health statute. So I'm just really concerned about that, because I think that it's necessary to bring individual people's stories to the forefront, but it's even more pressing to push for a public policy perspective to use those individual stories to change the law.
Well, most of the individual stories have largely been unknown because the American public doesn't know who the individuals are at Guantanamo. In terms of the policy regarding torture, the whole essence of Guantanamo is to find these legal loopholes in the Geneva Convention. Definitely everything that the United States has been doing in terms of creating these detention centers outside of U.S. jurisdiction in places like Guantanamo and other countries is for the purpose of circumventing the Constitution and the principles upon which our country was founded upon. And, you know, the administration will say things like, these are bomb makers and the worst of the worst. And I agree, there are very likely to be people at Guantanamo and perhaps in CIA detention centers who are the worst of the worst and who even deserve to be called evil. But we've tried terror suspects on U.S. soil before. We have ways of dealing with this. We did this with the first World Trade Center bombing, and it's not an excuse to create these detention centers in places where our laws don't reach and our courts don't have jurisdiction. You know, give them a trial, and if they are guilty of these terrorism-related charges, then lock them up. But furthermore, the other assumption is that these medieval torture techniques actually can bring about confessions of intelligence value, and there's been study after study to suggest that, you know, when you put a razor blade up to people's genitals, which has happened to some of the detainees, they're going to say anything. I mean, if somebody put a razor blade to me, I would say that I worked with Osama too, or turned my grandma in, or whatever. So it's just, I mean, it's ludicrous to think that these methods are effective in bringing about truth.
Right. My question, and I don't mean this to be hostile at all, I'm on the exact same page as far as due process and torture and all of that, but on a factual level, you know, if you read Scalia's dissent in the Mubadin, there's a number of people who were released from Guantanamo who returned to the battlefield and wound up killing innocent civilians.
Right.
And I was just wondering on a personal level for you if any of these people were in your book or if you knew any of these people that you met with at Guantanamo that told you that they were a baker and then wound up killing, you know, 20, 30 people in a terrorist incident, as has been well documented.
I read Scalia's dissent, and the Department of Defense, and he bases his dissent on the notion that 30 Guantanamo detainees have returned to the battlefield. First of all, there were 800, and out of 30, the recidivism rate is very low compared to criminals returning to crime released from U.S. prisons. But two, the battlefield, as defined by the Department of Defense, is a very general term. Of those 30, and they won't press, they've never given names of who these 30 are. That includes the Tipton Three, which were three British individuals who were detained. And after they were released, they made a film on Guantanamo. It's called The Road to Guantanamo. And they were classified as returning to the battlefield because they made this film against the United States. Another group of detainees, the Uyghurs, who were Chinese Muslims, and they gave an interview to the New York Times, and they were classified as returning to the battlefield. So if the New York Times is the battlefield, I'm a little bit, you know, their definition of battlefield is very vague. In terms of individuals who actually did go back and build themselves up on a battlefield, it's hard to say whether they returned to the battlefield or Guantanamo enraged them so much because, you know, if you were imprisoned for 7 years and faced strip searches and torture and 15 full cavity searches day after day just to humiliate you, I mean, it's very possible that Guantanamo in itself is creating terrorists. So it's unknown whether these people are returning to the battlefield or they were just so angry and, you know, damaged at Guantanamo. And the Department of Defense's figures and Justice Scalia's, you know, what he relied on in his dissent has never been substantiated. The military has never given the names of who these individuals are, and they've been pressed on that. And again, you know, is the New York Times the battlefield? Returning to the battlefield is giving an interview or creating a film, and those people were included in that.
There's a question about the legal status of some of these incidents. I know that in the original invasion of Afghanistan, the quest for Osama bin Laden was essentially a bill of attainder because there was no extradition order ever passed to the Afghani government. They remarked several times publicly that they would be glad to process a request for extradition if an indictment and that paperwork was given to them, but we just invaded Afghanistan instead. That was one of the things they listed in the charges against King George, was bills of attainder. But I was curious, do you happen to know, has Osama bin Laden ever actually been indicted for anything?
I don't know.
I've been trying to find out, and I was curious, but he doesn't seem to have been actually charged.
I don't know, but I'll Google it.
He's not a nice guy, but
no, he's
has he
not.
Actually been indicted for anything?
Unfortunately, we have reached the time to. We have only for one more question, so if anyone has any last question.
Hi, I'm a radio broadcaster. And when we bring these kind of subjects to the people and we open the mic, they're very frustrated. And they're very sad and angry, and they would like us to say something positive if there is a light at the end of the tunnel for all of this. What do you think we can tell these people to make them feel better?
Who are these people?
I'm a radio broadcaster, and when we open the mic and they call our radio station, and they're very upset, very angry, they would like to know when is this going to end. What can we do to help?
Well,
I don't think so.
The one thing that, I don't know if this is an answer to your question or just a general tangent, but I often get people wondering if I'm like anti-American, and it's completely the opposite. I think that, you know, these people get upset and they see that, but, and they speak out, and I wrote this book and I went to Guantanamo initially because I do believe that America is a wonderful, great country and the best country to live in the world. And I feel most at home here than any place else in the world. And I feel that this administration is very different from the country and the people, and the American people don't know. And I think it's a patriotic thing to do to stand up for your country and speak out when you think that the principles that makes this country great are being hijacked. So I guess, you know, remind those callers that this country is great because of people like them and because they feel the way they do.
Our thanks to Ms. Mavish Khan, author of my Guantanamo Diary, for her interesting and informative comments here tonight. So,
thank you all for coming. It really means a lot to me.
We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recorded version of this program. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.